For Maine Public Radio and MainePublic.org, I'm Ed Morin, bringing you the news on this day in Maine, Friday, April 21st, 2017. And on this day, a new report finds that students in Maine schools are restrained and secluded thousands of times a year. A former state prosecutor is denying allegations that she mishandled a murder trial 25 years ago. That's ahead in a moment.
This Day in Maine is made possible by listeners like you and by the Law Offices of Joe Bornstein, dedicated to serving injured and disabled Mainers from Kittery to Caribou, joebornstein.com, and by USM's Muskie School of Public Service Masters of Policy Planning and Management, preparing students to be a force for positive change in their communities.
The former state prosecutor who won a murder conviction against Anthony Sanborn 25 years ago is denying allegations that she mishandled the trial. Sanborn was granted bail last week after a key witness for the state recanted her testimony. As Patty White reports, attorney Pamela Ames says she's disturbed that the judge granted bail after only hearing witnesses for the defense.
The crime occurred 28 years ago on a Portland pier. 16-year-old Jessica Briggs was stabbed to death and dumped in Casco Bay. Her former boyfriend, Anthony Sanborn, was convicted of her killing. He was also just 16 at the time. And a key witness who testified that she saw Sanborn commit the crime was 13-year-old Hope Cady. But at a hearing last week in Cumberland County Unified Criminal Court, Cady recanted her testimony and said that police told her what to say. Cady also disclosed that she had vision problems all her life. A state caseworker who was Cady's guardian in 1989 also testified that she was aware of Cady's vision limitations. Anthony Sanborn's attorney, Amy Fairfield, argued that the state knew this, but never disclosed it to the defense during Sanborn's trial. Fairfield said this new evidence cast doubt on Cady's original testimony and, therefore, Sanborn's guilt. She asked Justice Joyce Wheeler to grant Sanborn bail, pending a hearing that could determine whether Sanborn's conviction is reversed, dismissed, or if he gets a new trial. Wheeler agreed, and Sanborn was released on bail last Thursday.
I am completely aghast that a judge would only hear part of the story and not even know the facts of the case.
That's Pamela Ames, an attorney in private practice who was a former assistant attorney general and the lead state prosecutor in Sanborn's case.
The fact that the judge did not hear from any witnesses from the state on the bail argument is completely unheard of and unprecedented.
Ames says she specifically asked Cady on the witness stand 25 years ago whether she had vision problems at the time Briggs was murdered, and Cady testified that she did not. Ames also says Cady came forward to police to give her witness account of the murder, the details of which are consistent with the medical examiner's report.
There is no way she could have written that statement in her own words unless she was there.
Ames, as well as two retired Portland police detectives, is also accused of threatening Cady and other witnesses. The police detectives deny those allegations in separate affidavits. Ames says she never threatened witnesses either.
There was nothing done that a witness was either intimidated or promised anything. Just did not happen. And it is a fabrication that says it did. And these witnesses wait 25 years and they wait until attorney Fairfield contacts them, apparently, to ask them if they wanted to recant their stories.
Defense attorney Amy Fairfield made a motion earlier this week to civilly arrest and detain Ames, claiming that attempts to issue her a subpoena to appear in court were unsuccessful. That motion was denied after the state said Ames will testify.
I am not ducking anything. As you can tell, I know this case. I remember this case. Backwards, forwards, and inside out.
The next hearing is scheduled for the end of May. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Patty White.
A new report finds that students in Maine are restrained and secluded within their schools approximately 13,000 times per year. As Robbie Feinberg reports, educational advocates want to see reforms at the state level to bring those numbers down.
The report from the advocacy group Disability Rights Maine comes 5 years after the state rewrote its regulations for the use of restraint and seclusion. Currently, the state requires that schools provide a written report whenever a staff member restrains a student, meaning they hold a student down or limit their movements, and when they seclude a student, meaning a staff member forces a student to sit alone in a room. Educators say these techniques are necessary to help control behavioral outbursts. Ben Jones disagrees.
You know, they're dangerous. And they're ineffective.
Jones is a staff attorney with Disability Rights Maine who points to research, including a 2012 report from the U.S. Department of Education, that says these techniques aren't effective and should only be used in emergency situations when a student could harm himself or others. So it surprised Jones when his organization studied the new state data and found that since 2013, Maine schools were using restraints and secluding students approximately 13,000 times. Per year.
So these are only to be used in emergency situations. So there's 13,000 emergencies happening in schools every year for these past 4 years, and these are dangerous, ineffective interventions. And so the number hit us.
While that number is large, it does need some context. State data show that those 13,000 incidents in 2016 involved about 1,800 students. In addition, state data show that the problem is much worse in special purpose schools for students with severe disabilities. Disability Rights Maine found that even though these schools hold less than 1% of Maine's student population, they account for 55% of the reported use of restraints and seclusions. In a written statement, Department of Education spokeswoman Rachel Paling said the department will, quote, always be concerned with any figures related to restraint and seclusion, no matter how high. She added that the report has also already led to some reforms at the state level, including significant changes in how the state collects data from individual schools. Yet despite the latest finding, both educational officials and advocates say things are going in the right direction. In a 2014 report to the Maine legislature, educators from across Maine said new state regulations on restraint and seclusion gave them more clarity on how to interact with students during outbursts.
Overall, I think that they've been embracing the new rule.
Deb Davis, an educational advocate who helped shape the new regulations, agrees that conditions have improved for teachers and students. However, she says the new report shows that many schools are still restraining and secluding students far too much. To fix the problem, Davis says she wants the state to work with schools and give them resources to help them stop situations from escalating.
So in some ways, by focusing so much on the crisis, it's not really helping us. We really need to do the work beforehand so we don't get to that point.
DOE spokeswoman Rachel Paling says the department will continue to look for ways to support those efforts within schools. However, it's still left to be seen if that will lower rates of restraint and seclusion in the future. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Robbie Feinberg.
The University of Maine system plans to clean up its investment portfolio by applying environmental, social, and governance criteria known as ESG. ESG criteria allow a company to weigh the sustainability and ethical impacts of an investment. The UMaine system will be seeking a new investment manager to steer the effort in the new fiscal year.
They'll be interviewing people and finding out how they will adhere to those ESG principles.
That's Cassandra Carroll with Maine Students for Climate Justice. She says while the ESG investing plan falls short of the complete fossil fuel divestment her group had been championing, she calls it a good first step, but she says she's hoping the Board of Trustees will involve the students in vetting the new investment manager.
Even if they don't have us sitting in on interviews, I hope that they will still communicate with us about, you know, what the different investment managers' stances are on certain sectors, like the energy sector, for example.
Carroll says they'll continue to push for complete fossil fuel divestment. Maine's birdwatching community is aflutter over the sighting this week of two species never before seen in Maine, one that usually hangs out in Mexico and the other in Europe. Fred Bever explains.
The first rare bird was caught on camera Monday thanks to an international user of a well-placed webcam at an osprey nest on Hog Island in Bremen.
The discovery was probably the coolest or most bizarre part of this.
Doug Hitchcocks is staff naturalist for the Maine Audubon Society.
The camera operator, who is this woman in Germany, zoomed in on this little red bird, took a picture of it, took a great video, got the word out, and ended up being the first state record of vermilion flycatcher, a bird that should be, you know, probably down in Mexico right now.
Once word was out, Hitchcocks and other birders rushed to the Society's Hog Island Research Center in time to see the flycatcher feasting on cluster flies rising from the facility's warming rooftops. And 2 days later, another birder driving through Newcastle spotted a field fare thrush that's native to Europe. Hitchcock says it's similar to the American robin, and this is the first time it's been seen in Maine. He also says both birds' visits to Maine are not a sign that climate change is at work. More random factors, an odd wind, or an individual bird's wanderlust are in play, he says, when a single bird strays far beyond its usual habitat. The gradual expansion of an avian species' range, however, can be attributed to climate change, Hitchcock adds. As with the northern cardinal or red-bellied woodpecker, both species once rare in Maine, which now are regular inhabitants. For Maine Public Radio News, I'm Fred Bever.
For more of today's Maine news, visit our website, mainepublic.org. And for Maine Public, that's This Day in Maine for Friday, April 21st. Thanks to Jennifer Mitchell, Susan Sharon, and our digital team, I'm Ed Morin.